five people come.
Yeah, I think they're coming in a little late. Okay, so we're recording. And there we go. Over to you.
Okay. All right. First thing I introduce. Okay, hello friends. Welcome to this 55th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Mercara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of Moria Federation, right up here in the upper left-hand corner. And if you haven't explored these two sites, the Moria Federation and the, where is it? There it is. And the Mercara, it's just that both are full of great stuff. Mercara especially is just a, it's like, has a tremendous library of materials. So just so you know. Okay, we began last session with an analysis of the last paragraph on the section entitled The Birthday of the Sun, which describes the three magi, a name given to Zoroastrian priests who follow the Star of Bethlehem in order to pay homage to the new sun god. The identity of this star has long been a topic of debate. As a possible candidate, Manly P. Hall puts forward a constellation called Praesepe Jovis in the constellation of Cancer. Jovis is the Roman name for Jupiter, therefore, Praesepe Jovis could be translated to mean the manger of Jupiter. Since Jupiter is the second ray lord, its conjunction with the manger would certainly be an appropriate celestial event for the birth of a Christ overshadowed avatar like Jesus. We then began a new section called The Three Suns, whose existence is a core tenet of theosophy. These suns, which we read a number of quotes on last time, are the central spiritual sun, the heart of the sun, and the physical sun, whose microcosmic correspondences are the monad, the soul, and the personality. We then considered how the three tabernacles, as described in Luke 9:33, are related to the outer court, the inner court, and the Holy of Holies, found in temples throughout the world. We then took a look at the phenomena called parhelion in meteorology, where three suns seem to appear, but which is actually produced by refraction of light off ice crystals. Next, we considered the teachings of Paracelsus, a Swiss physician, alchemist, philosopher, and theologian of the German Renaissance, who articulated the difference between the physical and spiritual suns. And finally, we revisited the three stages of alchemy by which one transforms the personality and identifies with one's higher self, the metaphor of which is the transformation of lead into gold. And that takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll continue in this session called The Three Suns. So, could we get a reader for this next section?
I'll start us off.
Great.
In the rare treatise, The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians, Franz Hartmann defines the sun alchemically as the symbol of wisdom, the center of power or heart of things. The sun is a center of energy and a storehouse of power. Each living being contains within itself a center of life, which may grow to be a sun. In the heart of the regenerated, the divine power, stimulated by the light of the Logos, grows into a sun which illuminates his mind. In a note, the same author amplifies his descriptions by adding, "The terrestrial sun is the image or reflection of the invisible celestial sun. The former is in the realm of spirit, what the latter is in the realm of matter. But the latter receives its power from the former." In the majority of cases, the religions of antiquity agree that the material visible sun was a reflector rather than a source of power. The sun was sometimes represented as a shield carried on the arm of the sun god, as, for example, Frey, the Scandinavian solar deity. This sun reflected the light of the invisible spiritual sun, which was the true source of life, light, and truth. The physical nature of the universe is receptive. It is a realm of effects. The invisible causes of these effects belong to the spiritual world. Hence, the spiritual world is the sphere of causation. The material world is the sphere of effects, while the intellectual or soul world is the sphere of motivation. Thus, Christ, the personified higher intellect and soul nature, is called the mediator, who, by virtue of his position and power, says, "No man cometh to the Father but by me."
Thanks, Beale. Okay, first, in the rare treatise, The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians, Franz Hartmann defines the sun alchemically as the symbol of wisdom, the center of power or heart of things. The sun is a center of energy and a storehouse of power. So here's Hartmann's really beautifully illustrated The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians. Just as Masons and Theosophists, Rosicrucians recognize the sun as the source of all energy within our solar system. Continuing with the quote, "Each living being contains within itself a center of life, which may grow to be a sun. In the heart of the regenerated, the divine power stimulated by the light of the Logos grows into a sun which illuminates his mind." So, we're talking about the shift from a fire by friction to solar fire. The quote unquote center of life is the indwelling jiva, temporarily imprisoned in the world of form. Through the work of the second logos, an aspect of the solar logos, this form is constantly modified to better suit the growing expression of the indweller. Eventually, this leads the pilgrim into the human kingdom, where, through the unfolding of the petals of the egoic lotus, followed by a series of initiations, he or she enters into full solar life expression. By the way, if you have any thoughts or questions about anything anytime during this webinar, please raise your hand. Dialogues are always more interesting than monologues. Okay, next, in a note, the same author amplifies his description by adding, "The terrestrial sun is the image or reflection of the invisible celestial sun. The former is in the realm of spirit, what the latter is in the realm of matter. But the latter receives its power from the former. So we see that, you know, in these, among the Rosicrucians, this idea of multiple suns was really part of their doctrine. The celestial sun is the theosophical central spiritual sun, which DK tells us is anchored at a point at the very center of the physical sun, which in turn is like a cave in the very center of the physical sun, which partakes of the essence of the central spiritual sun, which in turn acts as a transformer of that high source, reflecting its energy throughout the cosmic physical plane and throughout the solar system. Next. In the majority of cases, the religions of antiquity agree that the material visible sun was a reflector rather than a source of power. The sun was sometimes represented as a shield carried on the arm of the sun god, as for example, Frey, the Scandinavian solar deity. So in this illustration at left, we see Frey with his sun shield. But I couldn't find any ancient sculptures. There's actually very few of this shield, though it appears early in the writings on Frey, 12th, 13th century writings on the sun god. The shield had definitely become a part of the lexicon of teaching. But no imagery, no ancient imagery. Next. This sun reflected the light of the invisible spiritual sun, which was the true source of life, light, and truth. The physical nature of the universe is receptive. It is a realm of effects. The invisible causes of these effects belong to the spiritual world. HPP expands on this subject in Transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Yes. Yvonne, can you read that for us, please? Hold on a minute. Let me... There you go. You should be able to unmute now.
In what relation does the sun, the highest form of fire we can recognize, stand to fire as you have explained it? A, the sun, as on our plane, is not even solar fire. The sun, we see, gives nothing of itself because it is a reflection, a bundle of electromagnetic forces, one of the countless myriads of knots of Fohat. Fohat is called the thread of primeval light, the ball of thread of iridine in this labyrinth of chaotic matter. This thread runs through the seven planes, tying itself into knots. Every plane being septenary, there are thus 49 mystical and physical forces, larger knots forming stars, suns, and systems, the smaller planets, and so on. Question: in what respect is the sun an illusion? A, the electromagnetic knot of our sun is neither tangible nor dimensional, nor even as molecular as the electricity we know. The sun absorbs, psychicizes, and vampirizes its subjects within its system. Further than this, it gives out nothing of itself. It is an absurdity, therefore, to say that the solar fires are being consumed and gradually extinguished. The sun has but one distinct function. It gives the impulse of life to all that breathes and lives under its light. The sun is the throbbing heart of the system, each throb being an impulse. But this heart is invisible. No astronomer will ever see it. That which is concealed in this heart, and that which we feel and see, its apparent flame and fires, to use a simile, are the nerves governing the muscles of the solar system, and nerves, moreover, outside of the body. This impulse is not mechanical, but a purely spiritual nervous impulse from transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to read another passage from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which describes how the central spiritual sun manifests through our physical sun. Can we get a reader, please?
Vian, can you read that for us, please? Vian? Okay, Scott.
Sorry, I had trouble unmuting. It got
okay, there you go.
For some reason. Thanks. Sorry, Biel. Within the sun, right at its very heart, is a sea of fire or heat, but not a sea of flame. Herein may lie a distinction that perhaps will convey no meaning to some. It is the center of the sphere and the point of fiercest internal burning, but has little relation to the flames or burning gases, whatever terms you care to use, that are generally understood to exist whenever the sun is considered. It is the point of fiercest incandescence, and the objective sphere of fire is but the manifestation of that internal combustion. This central heat radiates its warmth to all parts of the system by means of a triple channel, or through its rays of approach, which in their totality express to us the idea of the heat of the sun.
Thank you, Vivian. So at the heart of this idea is this statement, the objective sphere of fire is but the manifestation of that internal combustion. So the source of the burning, you could say, the source of the fire is actually on higher planes. It comes from the heart of the sun and the central spiritual sun. And that the outer is just the an objective manifestation of that internal combustion. Okay. Finally, we have, hence the spiritual world is the sphere of causation. The material world is the sphere of effects, while the intellectual or soul world is the sphere of mediation. Thus, Christ, the personified higher intellect and soul nature, is called the mediator, who, by virtue of his position and power, says, "No man cometh to the Father but by me." All divine mediators ultimately draw their energy from the heart of the sun. In A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, D.K. lists those entities and forces that express this mediator aspect, the second aspect. Can we get a reader for this list?
Yes, but first I want to say that Ann Veronica put in the chat the triple channel, the Ida, the Pingala, and the Shushumna.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, reader, let me get down here. Sorry, Scott, can you read that for us, please? You should be able to unmute.
There we go. One, the second planetary center, the hierarchy. Two, the activity of the second ray, love wisdom. Three, the second initiation, which relates the solar plexus to the heart, humanity to the hierarchy, and the personality to the egoic rays to the second, which is ever basically in manifestation. Four, the second ray center, the heart center. Five, the second plane, The astral plane. This is the reflection of the second highest plane. 6. The second periodical vehicle, the soul. 7. The second divine aspect, love wisdom. 8. The second type or grade of messenger, Christ, Buddha. 9. The sustaining life, the second or subjective sun, the heart of the sun.
So this this last in the list relates to our subject here, that it's this, you could say that the ultimate source of the sun, which is the central spiritual sun, uses the second or subjective heart of the sun as the means of projecting itself on its own high plane into outer manifestation, just as we see other examples through here. Okay, next up, the final paragraph of this section on the three suns. Can we get a reader, please?
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I can. The three suns continued. What the sun is to the solar system, the spirit is to the bodies of man. For his natures, organs, and functions are as planets surrounding the central life, or sun, and living upon its emanations. The solar power in man is divided into three parts, which are termed the threefold human spirit of man. All three of these spiritual natures are said to be radiant and transcendent. United, they form the divinity in man. Man's threefold lower nature, consisting of his physical organism, his emotional nature, and his mental faculties, reflects the light of his threefold divinity and bears witness of it in the physical world. Man's three bodies are symbolized by an upright triangle, his threefold spiritual nature by an inverted triangle. These two triangles, when united in the form of a six-pointed star, were called by the Jews the Star of David, the signet of Solomon, and are more commonly known today as the Star of Zion. These triangles symbolize the spiritual and material universes linked together in the constitution of the human creature, who partakes of both nature and divinity. Man's animal nature partakes of the earth, his divine nature of the heavens, his human nature of the mediator. It's beautiful.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, first, what the sun is to the solar system, the spirit is to the bodies of man, for his natures, organs, and functions are as planets surrounding the central life, or sun, and living upon its emanations. Okay, by the term solar system, MPH seems to be referring to the planets, comets, etc., that rotate around the sun. However, DK describes the solar system, which includes the sun, as an entity of markedly greater consciousness than the physical sun. So we see here that in modern theosophy, just the physical sun would not be considered as in relation as the spirit to the bodies of man. But you would say that the solar system as the reflection of the central spiritual sun would be considered as the spirit is to the bodies of man. It's just a little tweak on the meaning there. At any rate, suns, planets, human beings, and even atoms of substance are all outer demonstrations of a monadic essence, which for the solar system, it's a central spiritual sun, which for human beings is anchored in the heart by means of the Sutratma, the microcosmic counterpart to the thread that links the spiritual sun to the center of the spiritual sun. I mean, center of the physical sun. let me say that again, because I confused the issue. So it's anchored in the heart by means of the Sutratma, the microcosmic counterpart to the thread that links the central spiritual sun to the center of the physical sun. So we have an as above, so below analogy there that works in large part, but not in the details. Next, the solar power in man is divided into three parts, which are termed the threefold human spirit of man. All three of these spiritual natures are said to be radiant and transcendent. United, they form the divinity in man. Descartes details man's threefold natures in Treatise on Cosmic Fire as will, expressing itself as electric fire, love wisdom, expressing itself as solar fire, and active intelligence, expressing itself as fire by friction, as shown here in the left-hand column. But it's interesting to note that in the downward shift from monad to ego, as shown in the third column of this chart, the flame of monad becomes the spark of the ego. Monadic light diversifies into the seven rays, and monadic heat demonstrates as substance and the permanent atoms. Next, man's threefold lower nature, consisting of his physical organism, his emotional nature, and his mental faculties, reflects the light of his threefold divinity and bears witness of it in the physical world. So continuing with the TCF chart, electric fire, solar fire, and fire by friction still characterize the three aspects, but in the personality vehicle, the monadic flame that became the egoic spark now demonstrates as thought generated by the lower mind. The monadic light of love wisdom that manifests through the seven rays now becomes astral desire. And monadic spiritual intelligence that becomes the conscious activity of the ego now demonstrates as prana and the activity of physical plane life. So, you know, we gain much understanding of the source nature of these qualities that demonstrate through the personality when we look at their higher counterparts. Next, man's three bodies are symbolized by an upright triangle, his threefold spiritual nature by an inverted triangle. These two triangles, when united in the form of a six-pointed star, were called by the Jews the Star of David, the Signet of Solomon, and are more commonly known today as the Star of Zion. These triangles symbolize the spiritual and material universes linked together in the constitution of the human creature who partakes of both nature and divinity. So we find a definitive statement on the six-pointed star in Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Magda, can you read that for us, please? You should be able to unmute now.
Yes. In all manifestation, we have duality producing triplicity. Spirit meets and contacts matter. The result of that contact is the birth of the sun, or the ego, the consciousness aspect. The egoic manifestation is therefore the middle aspect, the place of at one moment, and after due evolutionary cycles, the place of balance or of equilibrium. In considering the manifestation of the ego, we are dealing with the point of central emphasis in man's threefold manifestation. We are concerning ourselves with that division of his nature, which concerns the process of making him the perfect six-pointed star during the preliminary stage, the threefold personality and the threefold triad, merged and blended and perfectly produced through the intermediate point, the casual body, and which, when the physical body is eliminated, makes him the five-pointed star or perfected Manasaputra. To state the whole in terms of fire, the casual body is produced by means of the positive life or fire of the spirit, electric fire, meeting the negative fire of matter or fire by friction. This causes the blazing forth of solar fire. The central blaze inevitably in due course burns up the third fire or absorbs its essence and is itself eventually blended with the fire of spirit and passes out of objective display.
Thank you. Any questions about this? I like this passage quite a bit. It focuses in on the symbology. Okay. And finally, man's animal nature partakes of the earth, his divine nature of the heavens, his human nature of the mediator. So this triple nature is symbolized by the Vesica Pisces, which can be created from the six-pointed star as shown here. The left circle represents spirit, the right circle, matter, and the almond-shaped intersection, the soul. Okay, next let's take a look at the illustration in the center of the page, which is from Moore's Hindu Pantheon. It's an extraordinary coffee table sized book with fabulous illustrations of the Hindu Pantheon. The illustration is entitled Surya, the Regent of the Sun. Can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Surya, the regent of the sun. Moore describes this figure as follows. The cast is 9 inches in height, representing the glorious god of day, holding the attributes of Vishnu, seated on a seven-headed serpent. His car, drawn by a seven-headed horse, driven by the legless Arun, a personification of the dawn or aurora. See Moore's Hindu Pantheon.
Thank you. The caption under the image of Moore's book reads, from a cast in the museum at the India House, copied from a sculpture in the temple of Vishveshvara at Benares. So here's the temple of Vishveshvara, where presumably this bronze can now be found. Surya is part of the primeval Vedic Trimurti, consisting of Agni, Vayu, and Surya, or fire, air, and the sun, which represent 3 occult degrees of fire. In the secret doctrine, HPB says, himself only a reflection of the central spiritual sun, Surya is the prototype of all those bodies that evolved after him. You can see these quote unquote bodies in the white mass of primordial human forms in the left part of this painting. So there's a real distinction between Surya and that great being who would be associated with the central spiritual sun. This is the personification of the physical sun. A passage a bit later in the Secret Darshan reveals why, quote, the glorious god of day is holding the attributes of Vishnu. Could we get a reader, please?
Ron Parker, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. In India, Fohad is connected with Vishnu and Surya in the early character of the first god, for Vishnu is not a high god in the Rig Veda. The name Vishnu is from the root Vish, to pervade, and Fohad is called the pervader and the manufacturer because he shapes the atoms from crude material. In the sacred texts of the Rig Veda, Vishnu also is a manifestation of the solar energy, and he is described as striding through the seven regions of the universe in three steps, the Vedic god having little in common with the Vishnu of later times. Therefore, the two, Surya and Vishnu, are identical in this particular feature, and one is the copy of the other.
Thank you, Anne. So the two most commonly found attributes of Vishnu are the conch, shown here, far right, representing the word of creation, and the Sudarshana chakra, a spinning 108 petal disc that represents the wholeness of existence, as well as the connection between the physical and the divine. So you could see why Surya would be holding that in this case. Well, here we have Vishnu holding it, but in this case, you also have this, I believe it's represented here. It's so, such a poor resolution here, but at any rate, this would be the connection kind of like an antikarana connection between the central spiritual sun and the outer manifestation represented by Surya. The higher, according to HPB, the original Vishnu, the Rig Veda, was in that way so similar to Surya, had the same attributes, carried the same symbols, right? Later, Vishnu came to represent the second logos and is more associated with the heart of the sun than the Surya aspect. So next up, seated on a seven-headed serpent, his car drawn by a seven-headed horse. So the seven-headed serpent is Sesha, who floats in the cosmic ocean upon which the throne of Brahma rests. HPB says, Sesha, or Ananta, the couch of Vishnu, is an allegorical abstraction symbolizing infinite time in space, which contains the germ and throws off periodically the efflorescence of this germ, the manifested universe. The seven-headed horse represents both seven cycles and the seven sacred planets. Basically, seven is the number of manifestation, and it also, whenever you have, for instance, seven horses, it would be the specific nature of each of those seven cycles. You can see, for instance, these horses have individual attributes and qualities, and that would represent the qualities of those cycles individually. Okay.
Francis?
Yeah.
Magda asks, are the concepts of archetype and prototype used in a complementary way in occult science?
Well, the archetype is going to be the source blueprint, very much like the plan of God, the plan, and would be connected with the second logos, who is the form creator, right, who draws from the material or third aspect in order to create the form. The prototype is connected with the manu, or the ideal version of the actual manifestation of the ideal version of the archetype. So the prototype is the outer manifestation, but is still idealized and therefore wouldn't be literal physical examples, but rather the materialization of the archetype. So the manu, for instance, represents the ideal humanity and would therefore be the prototype for a particular race of humanity. I saw that you put your hand up. Magda, do you have something to add to that?
Go ahead.
Yes. Yes, thank you. And so I'm thinking, since in the image you just showed a few minutes ago, prototype, the word prototype was used in connection with Arun, Aurora, Arju. I was thinking archetype in connection with the phantoma concepts of Steiner. So if Vishnu as emanation of the solar logos is the prototype of the central sun, which is the archetype, how can I connect this this subject with the phantoma for this race that Christ brought down to density?
The what of the race that brought down, that Christ brought into
the phantom. I don't know what's in English, but it's like the blueprint of that race, or entelechia is the schematic physical and etheric and astral body of the human race, which right. that prototype of the solar logos brings down into density through the incarnation of high entities.
Right. So I still hear the description, but I don't get the question. What is the relation?
Yeah, between the prototype, which here is connected with Vishnu, if I understand correctly.
It can be. It's the prototype is can also be connected with the idealized third aspect, like the etheric. It's relational, prototype is. So it's the blueprint of the outer, the archetype, you could say, is the blueprint of the prototype. And, you know, at archetypal levels, I would see actually the archetype, you know, in terms of the three aspects, I would look at archetype at the Vishnu level rather than the central spiritual sun, because that's pure spirit. That's not yet in consideration of the form aspect at all. Whereas at that level of the heart of the sun or of Vishnu, you would then have that second logoic energy coming into play, which would then represent the archetype. I bet if we were to look at the names of the second logos, which you can find in Esoteric Psychology 1, of the second ray lord, really, that you would find some quality of the archetype mentioned, something about the archetype mentioned. And then the prototype would be the idealized outer demonstration of the archetype. That's how I understand it. But
thank you.
Yeah, I think it's archetype, prototype, or are relational in that way. You know, I mean, just like if you're making an object, the archetype would be really the idea. And in the mind of the architect, right, which is very much associated with that second aspect. And then the prototype would be the literal physical demonstration of that, of whatever that is, that represents all that will follow. Very much like Surya here represents, here represents the prototype of all the those bodies that evolve after him. Well, that's what it says, prototype of all those bodies. The archetype would be at that next level up that then reflects the prototype. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, we're here. Okay, next we begin a new section entitled The Celestial Inhabitants of the Sun. Can we get a reader, please? BL?
Oh, sorry. Ben, can you read that for us, please? Well, I'm not getting a response, so let's see about Gordon, can you read that for us, please?
Yes.
There we go. Thank you.
Celestial inhabitants of the sun. The Rosicrucians and the Illuminati, describing the angels, archangels, and other celestial creatures, declared that they resembled small suns, being centers of radiant energy surrounded by streamers of virilic force. From these outpouring streamers of force is derived the popular belief that angels have wings. The wings are the corona-like fans of light, by means of which the celestial creatures propel themselves through the subtle essences of the superphysical worlds. Two mystics are unanimous in their denial of the theory that the angels and archangels are human in form, as so often pictured. A human figure would be utterly useless in the ethereal substances through which they manifest. Science has long debated the probability of the other planets being inhabited. Objections to the idea are based upon the argument that creatures with human organisms could not possibly exist in the environments of Mars, Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune. This argument fails to take into account nature's universal law of adjustment to environment. The ancients asserted that life originated from the sun, and that everything, when bathed in the light of the solar orb, was capable of absorbing the solar life elements and later radiating them as flora and fauna.
Thank you. Okay, first, the Rosicrucians and the Illuminati, describing the angels, archangels, and other celestial creatures, declared that they resemble small suns. Wait a minute. Is that right? Yeah. Being centers of radiant energy surrounded by streamers of virilic force. The Rosicrucian description of angels and archangels comes from the secret doctrine of the Rosicrucians by the magus incognito, which just means the hidden magician. Vrilic force, or vril, is a term coined by Edward Bulwer Lytton in his novel The Coming Race, published in 1871. But HPB assures us in The Sacred Doctrine that vril is not a fiction, but a true and terrible force known by the Hindus and rediscovered by John Keeley. Could we get a reader for this?
Oops. Sorry. Arian, can you read first, please? You should be able to unmute yourself.
If the question is asked why Mr. Keeley was not allowed to pass a certain limit, the answer is easy. Because that which he has unconsciously discovered is the terrible sidereal force known to and named by the Atlanteans, Mashmak, and by the Aryan rishis in their Ashtar Vidya, by a name that we do not like to give. It is the vril of Bulwer Lytton's coming race, and of the coming races of our mankind. The name vril may be a fiction. The force itself is a fact doubted as little in India as the existence of the rishis, since it is mentioned in all the secret works. It is this vibratory force which, when aimed at an army from an Agni Rath, fixed on a flying vessel, a balloon, according to the instructions found in Ashtar Vidya, that reduced to ashes 100,000 men and elephants as easily as it would a dead rat. It is allegorized in the Vishnu Purana, in the Ramayana and other works, in the fable about the sage Kapila, whose glance made a mountain of ashes of King Sagara's 60,000 sons, and which is explained in the esoteric work and referred to as the Pali Laksha, Kapila's eye.
Thank you. So, you know, we can assume that this great force derives from the first aspect, even if it's a sub-aspect of the third aspect, you know, which any force that can demonstrate on the physical plane would have to be. But certainly it carries the energy of Shiva, for it to have this kind of potency. You know, we have our equivalent would be in, you know, nuclear weapons today. I have to add, by the way, that HPB's, that after HPB's passing, Keeley was generally considered to be a fraud, even by Colonel Olcott, who lived long enough to see him exposed. You know, I had heard this, dismissed it, thinking that it was just exoteric science's inability to understand what Keeley was actually up to and all about. But when Colonel Olcott expressed his doubts about Keeley, that made me sit up and listen. Nonetheless, you know, he had a number of machines that were probably his most famous claim was the idea of perpetual motion, which was never demonstrated actually to anyone. Okay, next up. From these outpouring streamers of force, that's the vrilic force that comes out of the Devic kingdom. The popular belief that angels have wings. These wings are corona-like fans of light, by means of which the celestial creatures propel themselves through the subtle essences of the superphysical world. Oops, somebody needs to mute. So in addition to the brilliant corona of light, wings on any spiritual being, you know, whatever culture, symbolize the ability to pass from one plane of existence to another, as in the case of Garuda, an eagle-like being who is the Vahan, or vehicle of Vishnu, and who enables Vishnu to penetrate into lower, more material planes. It's interesting, there's also a teaching that the reason that he has this gargoyle-like face, which we see as ugly, is because everything is reversed from the spiritual to the material planes. And then in fact, the visage of this Vahan, called Garuda, is beautiful beyond human imagination. But because we are unable to process that beauty, we see it as in this distortion. I always thought that was a really interesting teaching. It's that reversal of spirit and physical, represented by ugliness and beauty. Okay, next up. True mystics are unanimous in their denial of the theory that the angels and archangels are human in form, as so often pictured. A human figure would be utterly useless in the ethereal substances through which they manifest. It's interesting to speculate on just what might be the true form of an angel or archangel, as opposed to the form they present to those seers who are able to perceive them, such as Jeffrey Hodson, whose drawings suggest streams of vrillic energy adapted to a human-like form aspect. But, you know, we have to wonder, is this something projected by this David presence so that they can be seen and recognized? Or, you know, for instance, does such a one as Jeffrey Hodson, was he actually able to see their quote unquote true form? Certainly this form must change depending on an angel's specific purpose, nature, and level of evolution, you know, as we see in the difference between these two. But also, it's going to be dependent on the level of consciousness of the seer. Because, you know, you can imagine that a seer could pierce into the lower levels of the form aspect of the David kingdom, but not actually be picking up visual aspects that occurred on higher levels that might be more essential to their true nature than the levels that are being perceived. It's just a possibility. Okay, finally, if anybody here has seen angels, you know, you could chime in at this point. Finally, science has long debated the probability of the other planets being inhabited. Objections to the idea are based upon the argument that creatures with human organisms could not possibly exist in the environments of Mars, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. This argument fails to take into account nature's universal law of adjustment to environment. The ancients asserted that life originated from the sun and that everything, when bathed in the light of the solar orb, was capable of absorbing the solar life elements and later radiating them as flora and fauna. So we have to keep in mind, first of all, that MPH was writing in the mid-1920s when scientific knowledge of the planets was in its infancy. You know, the idea that there could be, for instance, a humanity on Mars survived well into the 20th century. And then when our telescopes got good enough where we could literally almost granularly see the surface of Mars, obviously the idea of any physical humanity was dismissed. But so for this reason, the humanities of the other planets in our solar system are either in Pralaya or carrying out their activities on more etheric planes of existence. Though to give MPH his due, I suppose it's possible that there are physical plane humanities on the gas giants, that we, since we can't penetrate the surface, of a constitution completely unlike anything science recognizes as capable of sustaining life. But I think this argument for physical plane human existence is sort of, first of all, it's unlikely, but it's also kind of beside the point, because I think that, you know, our true physical existence is etheric in nature. And it would be in, you know, since the etheric bodies are impervious to, you know, the outer, for instance, temperature conditions, that sort of thing, they could certainly, etheric forms of humanity certainly could exist on the other planets, as well as even, you know, higher plane forms of humanity. In other words, these humanities could be evolving very much like we evolve, but they would be doing it on the inner planes rather than the outer. And also we have to, you know, put forth the idea that some of these humanities could be between cycles in Pralaya, which is why there's no visible form. DK says it's at one point that, you know, our climate, says a comment about climate, that when humanity has evolved to the point where it no longer needs to physically manifest, that the climate will change and won't necessarily support outer existence anymore. And that, you know, that could have already happened on some of the other planets. Okay, thoughts or questions about any of this?
Yes, we have a comment from Julianne. She says, I've seen an angel once about 15 years ago, had a human form, the most beautiful man like a Greek god, although made of luminous blue radiating light. I knew it was an angel by the feeling of overwhelming, overflowing love and joy evoked.
Hmm. Well, that's fantastic. You know, the question then becomes, did this being project this image into your consciousness for your benefit? I mean, I have no doubt that there was a being at the other end of your vision. Or were you seeing some aspect of this, of the actual being? It's not really a question we can answer, but it's very interesting. Thank you for sharing.
Francis?
Yeah.
Can I do a plug for my esoteric astrology presentation at the conference?
Sure.
It's on Angels of Aquarius. And I delve a little bit into archangels and their relationship to the signs, and then the signs and their specific angels for that. And one of the things that's interesting, and it's something DK tells us, is that the angels will come at the time of the externalization of the hierarchy, and that for those of us who have the inner sight and can speak their language, we can hear them. But that's a higher evolution kind of a thing. But anyway, I thought it was really interesting that they're part of the hierarchy. They're closely related to the hierarchy. And of course, a lot of the work they're doing is on the inner planes right now, but they are supposedly part of the externalization of the hierarchy. So anyway, that will be my esoteric astrology presentation at the conference.
Awesome. So if you attend, you get extra credit, everybody, just so you know. I look forward to that, BL. That'll be great. It's a fascinating topic. You know, the Christ is said to be the teachers of angels and of men, master of masters. And so, you know, it's, even though it's not talked about much, DK doesn't talk about it much, certainly great devas are part of the hierarchy, you know, since we have high initiates making up the hierarchy, and there is a blending of the two lines of the human and Davic lines, awareness, a certain very powerful awareness comes at the fourth initiation, and then a literal fusion at the sixth initiation, then certainly those great beings would be part of the hierarchical force field, you could say. All right, next up, we turn to page 52 in the folio edition to finish up this short section on the celestial inhabitants of the planet. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. First, I want to say, Magda says, I am in the understanding that angelic hierarchies and masters after the fourth initiation and over incarnating for externalization are the same concept.
Read that again. Well, actually, I'll pull it up. Let me read it. I'm in the angelic hierarchies and masters of the fourth initiation, reincarnation. Well, I am not seeing that, you know, a human, you know, a master of wisdom is considered the perfect human. It's at the very top of the of that level of human becoming. At the sixth initiation, you literally move beyond the human kingdom, and you enter fully the fifth kingdom. So that's what I understand masters after the fourth initiation to be. And for that reason, I don't see them, the angelic hierarchies, as the same as masters after the fourth. However, starting at the fourth initiation, this blending begins to occur. Initiating and over incarnating for externalization. I'm not sure what you mean by this last part. And over incarnating for externalization are the same concept. But yeah, anyway, those are my thoughts on that. Did you want to add something, Magda?
You should be able to unmute now.
Yes, I think you understood somehow. We're talking here about archangels, you know, being visible or not visible. So, and how and in which, you know, in which lighting shape. And then I was in the understanding that after fourth initiation, beginning with the blending, you know, with the blending with the cosmic intelligence, after the fourth initiation and then going on more intensively after second initiation, then the talk, the discussion about if there are defined angels or archangels, or if you define them in theosophy, high entities incarnating in human bodies are actually the same thing, the same concept that we're talking about. Now, you said after fourth initiation starts the real blending with the cosmic intelligence. So I was wondering if we can draw a parallel, an exact parallel between the angelic hierarchies and which kind of level of masters, since we are facing here very closely the externalization of hierarchies, hopefully. You know, I'm trying to draw a parallel between the Occidental definition of the 3, 3, and 3, 3, 6, and 9 angelic hierarchies, you know, angels, archangels, archive, and principles, and so on.
Right.
And, you know, drawing this kind of parallel, if it has any, you know, detailed sense. It has, for me, like a general sense. You know, I was trying with you to get into more details, and you helped me by saying after fourth initiation, the blending starts. And so, you know, that started me going on a trace that I can develop.
Right. We can assume that at a certain point, these greater Devic beings are part of the same hierarchy. I think the angelic hierarchies at lower levels, devas and elementals, are distinct, and their purpose is different than the human hierarchy. But there would come a point where there would become an interblending. Now, it's interesting because, you know, we're given, for instance, names of various masters of wisdom in the human hierarchy, in the, you know, the hierarchy that stands between Shambhala and humanity. There's not much description of great Mahadevas working in that hierarchy, but I can't imagine that this wouldn't be the case. It seems to me that they would very much be a part of that same, you know, august body. You know, and that it could be that devas below a certain grade would then not have that type of commerce with the what's called the human hierarchy, except for in terms of being under the command of certain masters for form building and that type of thing. But you know, it's fascinating topic, and as to the Christian language of you know different angelic levels, I think it's difficult to draw direct parallels because it's a completely different developmental doctrine, and we have to infer. Looking at one whole world compared to the theosophical world, where they might, you know, at what level they might interrelate. But it's very difficult, you know, to say, for instance, just at what level, what initiation is an archangel, for instance. You know, DK never tells us. But it would certainly be a high initiate, you know, and certainly there would have been a blending with the two kingdoms at that point of the archangel. And then for the outer demonstration, which for an archangel would be a very high inner demonstration, would be Devic rather than, you know, what we normally think of as Chohans sixth and seventh initiates. So yeah, more questions than answers.
Francis, sorry.
That's all right.
Are you, okay. I just pulled up my presentation because there's a nice quote in there from Initiation Human and Solar, page 222, and it, where DK tells us that the term planetary logos is generally applied to the seven highest spirits corresponding to the seven archangels of the Christian. They have all passed through the human stage and are now manifesting through a planet and its evolutions in the same way that man manifests through his physical body. The highest planetary spirit working through any particular globe is, in reality, the personal God of the planet. I just wanted to point that out.
Well, thank you. That's fantastic information. The question then becomes, is the Logos an archangel? Or is it part of the equation? Is the Logos, for instance, the Devas are usually seen as the feminine aspect and the human is the masculine aspect of the two streams. Is this Mahadeva or archangel, that is at the level of the planetary spirit itself, is that, you know, part of that duality, or is it indeed, is a logos an archangel?
Or is it a dual, like with Sunat Kumara and the actual planetary logos? There was also a reference in Secret Doctrine about the seven planetary spirits or angels being identical with the Daihan Chohans of the esoteric doctrine, and then transformed into archangels in the Christian church. So there are so many interesting things when you begin to look at this, and some of them contradict each other, but I thought these particular things were pretty interesting. So
yeah, the quote is great. That's because there are not many quotes where he does that kind of comparisons between systems like that, so that's useful, and it also elevates this idea of an archangel quite a bit from, you know, I was thinking 6-7 initiate kind of thing, and you're looking, you shift to a completely higher octave when you're looking at planetary initiations. Our planetary logos is preparing to take the fourth in this fourth globe of the fourth chain of the fourth round, right? So what is the ramification of that in terms of the angelic kingdom? And it's quite interesting. Okay, anyone else? Anything else?
You need a reader now?
Didn't we just read this? No. Yes, we need a reader.
Okay. Marguerite, I've asked you to unmute, so can you read that for us, please?
Yes, hi. One philosophical concept regarded the sun as a parent and the parents as embryos still connected to the solar body by means of ethereal umbilical cords, which served as channels to convey life and nourishment to the planets. Some secret orders have taught that the sun was inhabited by a race of creatures with bodies composed of a radiant spiritual ether, not unlike in its constituency, the actual glowing ball of the sun itself. The solar heat had no harmful effect upon them because their organisms were sufficiently refined and sensitized to harmonize with the sun's tremendous vibratory rate. These creatures resemble miniature suns, being a little larger than a dinner plate in size, although some of the more powerful are considerably larger. Their color is a golden white light of the sun, and from them emanate four streamers of brill. These streamers are often of great length and are in constant motion. A particular palpitation is to be noted throughout the structure of the globe and is communicated in the form of ripples to the emanating streamers. The greatest and most luminous of these spheres is the Archangel Michael and the entire order of solar life, which resemble him and dwell upon the sun, are called by modern Christians the archangels or the spirits of the light.
Thank you. Interesting stuff. Okay, first up, one philosophical concept regarded the sun as parent and the planets as embryos still connected to the solar body by means of ethereal umbilical cords, which served as channels to convey life and nourishment to the planets. So this is a 17th century concept described by the, it was proposed by the German mystic Johann Gichtel in his book, Theosophia Practica. As do theosophists, Gichtel believed that the sun is the visible manifestation of God, that planets have souls and are undergoing a process of spiritual development. But whereas Descartes teaches that the planets are the solar systemic chakras, and HPB teaches that they are siblings of the physical sun, Gichtel believed them to be solar offspring. Gichtel had a series of visions of the solar system, which he illustrated. They are quite fascinating. And you could see, for instance, in this one on the left, that there certainly is a relationship to the theosophical idea that the planets related to certain chakras of the sun, at least certain parts of the body, even though they're not in the same, necessarily in the same positions that theosophy would put them in. Certainly a precursor in some aspects to the theosophical doctrine. Okay, the remainder of this paragraph focuses on a, quote, race of creatures that live within the sun. One of the, quote, unquote, secret orders that held this theosophical belief is the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which believes that solar angels reflect the light and life of the solar logos. This is, you know, absolutely in sync with the theosophical belief. The Golden Dawn also believes that solar angels resemble miniature suns and are connected to the sun by invisible cords of light, just as MBH was describing, which allows them to travel through different subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. So these streamers, these energetic vril streamers allow them to travel through the subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, at least according to this Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Many illustrious members of the Golden Dawn, such as the poet William Butler Yeats, the author Samuel MacGregor Mathers, who wrote some extraordinary works, and Arthur Edward Waite of Tarot fame, wrote about their mystical experience, including direct contact and vision of these solar beings or solar angels. It's extraordinary. Okay, next up, a new section called The Sun in Alchemical Symbology. Could we get a reader, please?
Julianne, can you read that for us, please? Let me find you. Oh, there. Now you should be able to unmute.
Yep, sure. The Sun in Alchemical Symbology. Gold is the metal of the sun and has been considered by many as crystallized sunlight. When gold is mentioned in alchemical tracts, it may be either the metal itself or the celestial orb, which is the source or spirit of gold. Sulfur, because of its fiery nature, was also associated with the sun. As gold was the symbol of spirit, and the base metals represented man's lower nature, certain alchemists were called miners and were pictured with picks and shovels digging into the earth in search of the precious metal, those finer traits of character buried in the earthiness of materiality and ignorance. The diamond concealed in the heart of the black carbon illustrated the same principle. The Illuminati used a pearl hidden in the shell of an oyster at the bottom of the sea to signify spiritual powers. Thus, the seeker, after the truth, became a pearl fisher. He descended into the sea of material illusion in search of understanding, termed by the initiates the pearl of great price.
Thank you. Okay, first, gold is the metal of the sun and has been considered by many as crystallized sunlight. When gold is mentioned in alchemical tracts, it may be either the metal itself or the celestial orb, which is the source or spirit of gold. So gold, which is the result of purification, refinement of the base metals such as lead, iron, and mercury through an involved process of heating, dissolving, distilling, and coagulating, represents the perfection of matter, the highest state of transformation, and is thus the ultimate goal of the alchemists. But it's important to remember that these processes are symbolic, representing stages of transformation, as described earlier, of the alchemist's own character and consciousness. BK tells us more about the transmutative process in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Can we get a reader, please?
Okay, hold on a minute here. Magda says, how do the sun, as we are talking about it now, as central source of life or alchemical, as gold or pearl, and the ancient sun's earth incarnation relate to each other?
Yeah, let me look at that. And the ancient sun's earth incarnation relate to each other. I'm not sure what that means. So how did the sun, which we're talking about now, is a central source of life, or alchemically is gold or pearl, and the ancient sun's earth incarnation related. So what's the sun's earth incarnation? You know, I have a feeling that because you're Steiner-based, that often our terminology is different. So I'm not sure what to make of this term, the ancient sun's earth incarnation. Could you explain that, Magda? Okay, old sun.
Yes, I'm referring to what you're saying as the definition of the planetary incarnations of Earth, so old Saturn or ancient Saturn, ancient sun, ancient moon, and then the present Earth incarnation.
Okay, what I'm hearing, and then, go ahead.
And then continuing with the future Jupiter and future Venus and Vulcano.
Right, yeah, there are, especially Saturn and the moon are associated with previous cycles. You know, the first solar system could definitely be called the old sun. And there's, it's very possible that Saturn was an especially important element in that first solar system because it represents the third aspect, the third ray, right? And so the current sun, which is represented by gold and pearl, you could say, is the fruit of the development of the, you could even call it the lead aspect. I never thought of this before, but you could look at just at a physical level that there was a transmutation of the cosmic physical plane itself, which is, you know, was the elements of the cosmic physical, the lower subplanes of the cosmic physical plane were developed in the previous solar system. And you could look at that development as a kind of alchemical process of moving from lead to gold, which now demonstrates, because gold is also very much connected with the second aspect, with the second ray aspect of the sun. That's about all I could do with that. And of course we know that the moon was the earth in a previous chain, was that globe D, which is our earth, in the previous chain. And that's so, you know, that's our earth's analogy for the sun in a previous solar system.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, that we're out of time. We'll start with this next time. So thank you all for coming. There's going to be a very, very important event happening tomorrow. You probably, most of you know about it. A really significant solar eclipse that's going to, in fact, I'll even pull it up. Okay. Just a minute. Getting there. No, I won't do any more than that. Wait a minute. That's getting close. All right, come on back. Well, that's about as close as I could make it for now. So this is the astrological chart for the new moon and the solar eclipse, which curiously happened 4 minutes apart from each other. I don't know why this won't be exactly right, but anyway. And there's some really interesting, here's the actual conjunction of the sun and moon, of course, which always happens at a new moon. It's only 4 minutes off from the eclipse. I always thought that they happened. Eclipses happen at the exact time of the sun and moon, but with a little research, I found that they can be a few minutes off. I couldn't tell you why. But there's a really amazing thing happening here with, there's also, let me pull up, Chiron is at the exact same degree and minute as the sun, as the sun moon. So it's literally partile conjunct, this conjunction of sun and moon. And then you also have the north node in conjunction and the and Mercury. All of this happening at the time of the solar eclipse. I think it's a very, very important event. Solar eclipses tend to open a new chapter, even a new book, you could say, definitely a new cycle. And it's interesting because, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a lunar eclipse, which the aspects of that, and I have them here, represented closure, completion. The end of a cycle. And so there's, you know, because these are bookends, it really suggests, you know, the energy of completion moving on to the opening of a new cycle. So it's very important. I'm going to be doing a webinar through Moria Federation on this event. It's going to be a meditation on the new moon, which happens every month, but this one's particularly significant because it's in relation to this great solar eclipse. Tuya usually does the new moons, but she's traveling, and so luckily I got to explore this theme. So if you get a chance, it's at 5:50. It's not what's in, yeah, 5:50 GMT. You have to translate in that into your own time zone. You can find it on the calendar of MoriFederation.com. So,
yeah, I'm getting ready to post that link into the thing right now. Let me just hit paste.
Okay, there good.
We go.
Earlier today, they had the time wrong. They had it at 16:50 when it's actually at 17:40, talking about GMT times. So if you...
Yeah, but Vic was working to fix that. So anyway, this is the calendar here. And it shows what, when, where, and how. It also has the links and everything for them when you go to that. So just get used to going to that Moira Federation calendar to check and see what all is going on.
Yeah. So even if you don't normally do new moon meditations, you may want to give this one a visit because it's of a particular importance. You know, I would call it one of the major events of the year, astrologically speaking, right? And we're going to do, I think, a real interesting meditation on this, as well as I'll be giving an astrological presentation, you know, beforehand. So hope to see you there. And then you want to give the calendar of events, Bia?
Sure. The 12th of April, 7 p.m. is the next Treatise on Cosmic Fire.
Is this coming?
Right, this coming Friday. The next Secret Doctrine is the 21st of April, so 2 weeks from today. And then the next time we meet for STOA is going to be the 5th of May.
Okay, real good. Okay, y'all, thanks so much for attending, and we'll see you at the next event, hopefully tomorrow, if you can make it. Okay, until then.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.